Caro, and welcome to Volume 44, Number 50 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 13th of December 2024. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreader Alison, plus Andy with another weird Norfolk tale. And in the news this week, will we be waving goodbye to our borough council? Wind farm work for the port? The other half of the Vauxhall Bridge could at last be painted. And Galston is losing an ancient tree. All this coming your way during the next hour or so. But first, a birthday. So it's best wishes for a great day this Sunday to Morris Hood. Many happy returns, Morris. We've got loads of news this week, so hastily across to Alison.
Tension is mounting over the future of Norfolk's councils, with the starting gun on a new scramble for power predicted to be fired next week. The prospect of councils being abolished and redrawn in the biggest shake-up of local government in Norfolk and Waveney since 1974 is expected to take a significant step forward within days. The imminent publication of a government white paper will trigger jostling for position as to which councils would continue to exist and which could disappear. Labour ministers who pulled the plug on devolution deals that the previous government had offered to Norfolk and Suffolk are keen to transfer powers from Whitehall to the two counties. But it has signalled a revived deal would have to come with local government reorganisation and a Norfolk-Suffolk mayor. That elected mayor would lead a combined authority for the two counties and have powers over big-ticket items such as transport, economic development and infrastructure. The shift is likely to see the current two-tier system of county councils and the city, borough and district authorities abolished and replaced with at least two or potentially more unitary councils. Norfolk County Council's Conservative leader, Kay Mason-Billick, has called for a grown-up reaction to whatever the government comes up with. While there is a general acceptance some form of reorganisation is inevitable, it is likely that district councils and the city council would fight for their futures. Previous attempts at local government reorganisation caused bad blood between politicians, including among those of the same political persuasion. They ended with the shake-ups being scrapped. Mrs. Mason-Billick told county councillors at a meeting on Tuesday that all the current leaders had recently held a Teams meeting to discuss what the future could hold. She said there was a sort of acceptance that if devolution happens, it is likely to be on a Norfolk and Suffolk-wide basis, and we would get a mayor over both counties. Not everyone was entirely happy about that, but I think there was an acceptance that it is the way the government is moving forwards. On local government reform, we don't know what we don't know, so there's no point in speculating about what the future shape of Norfolk and Suffolk might be at this point in time. We're waiting to see what the white paper says. We have agreed that the last thing that local government leaders need to be doing in our two counties is infighting. We've seen it happen before, when local government reform raised its head in 2010 and 2016. We've agreed that we must be grown-ups about this, and we'll meet again in the new year, if not before, if we get some further information. In 2016, the government offered Norfolk and Suffolk a devolution deal, which would have seen powers devolved to local councils, bringing in £750 million of new funding for infrastructure and £130 million for new homes. But the government insisted the two counties must have a single elected mayor, which led to Norwich, Great Yarmouth, Breckland and North Norfolk councils withdrawing from the process. Other councils voted against it and the deal was taken off the table. That followed a previous bitter dispute over a switch away from the current two tiers of local government to a single tier unitary authority. In 2009, the Boundary Commission recommended a single unitary authority covering all of Norfolk, which would have seen district and borough councils disappear. Supporters said it would save money, but critics questioned that and said it would take decisions making away from communities. Norfolk County Council made a play to become a unitary authority, as did Norwich City Council, and it was announced that Norwich would become a unitary authority. But at the 11th hour, shortly after the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats formed a coalition government in 2010, Local Government Secretary Eric Pickles took steps to reverse that decision so it never happened. The current two-tier system, which means Norfolk has Norfolk County Council, Norwich City Council, Great Yarmouth Borough Council, Broadland District Council, South Norfolk Council, Breckland District Council, North Norfolk District Council, and West Norfolk Council, was introduced in 1974. The County Council is currently responsible for services such as adult social care, children's services, libraries, museums, and running tips, while districts deal with housing, leisure centres, and parks. Unitary authorities would run all those services. In some areas where local government has been restructured, parish and town councils, which cover much smaller areas, have been strengthened further, but some areas with unitary authorities do not have any. Norfolk faces millions of pounds of extra cuts because of government plans to redirect money from rural shires towards urban areas of the UK. Leaders at Conservative-controlled County Hall claim the region will be unfairly punished by the changes to how cash is distributed to local authorities. Norfolk County Council is already facing an £11.3 million overspend on this year's budget and a potential £15 million bill because of national insurance and living wage changes. On top of that, it needs to make £45 million of cuts and savings to balance the books next year, with particular pressure on adult social care and children's services. But Andrew Jamieson, deputy leader and cabinet member for finance, claims up to another 6 million more cuts will be needed as a result of the Labour government's proposed changes to rural delivery grants. These are intended to cover the higher costs of providing services in rural areas, but Labour has said it intends to replace the outdated and inefficient system with what it says will be a fairer one, which, quote, matches funding with need. At a meeting of the council's cabinet, Mr. Jamieson said, "What we can see is that the government is signalling a move of funding from the shires to other parts of the country. Early indications from the county council's network imply that some or even all counties could get nothing at all from this repurposed funding. Were this to be the case here in Norfolk, it would mean that nearly £6 million more savings need to be found. It becomes increasingly difficult for this council to deliver services in adults and children's services, in particular, over and above those that we are statutorily obliged to do. The government has pledged a £600 million recovery grant for councils in deprived areas, an increase in social care funding of £680 million, and a £250 million social care grant for preventative initiatives. But the County Council will not discover what share it will get until December the 19th, with its budget due to be set 2 months later." Kay Mason-Billig, leader of the council, said, "We are in uncertain times. Any shift from rural areas to urban ones will do untold damage to residents in Norfolk, where we have to spend more money to deliver the services. We have an older population and that should be recognised. We cannot afford to be left high and dry by this new government, and that is what we appear to be facing." Bill Borrett, Cabinet Member for Public Health, said, "It's not rocket science. We know that to provide services for people scattered over a wide rural area, it is more expensive than it is in central London. If the Rural Services Delivery Grant is going to be affected, then it's just bonkers. We have vulnerable people in rural areas. I don't believe this is fair, I don't believe it is equitable, and I believe the people who will suffer are those who live in rural areas, and that is wrong." The government says, on average, councils serving rural populations will receive an increase of about 5% in their core spending power. Labour has said that in the longer term, it also intends to announce multi-year funding for councils, something Mr. Jamieson has long called for, to help with financial planning. Steve Morphew, leader of the Labour group at County Hall, said the formula for determining how much money we get is so complicated that consolidating the rural needs into the basic formula makes a lot of sense. You'd expect to see a Labour government focusing on areas which most need investment. But that doesn't mean to say a rural area like Norfolk, which was missed out by the previous government, won't be properly resourced. The future of councils in Norfolk is uncertain, with speculation a white government paper will pave the way for district councils to be abolished as part of local government reorganisation. That would see the introduction of unitary councils and a Norfolk-Suffolk mayor. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has revealed its final draft local plan and is inviting public feedback before government submission. The local plan is a crucial document that outlines the area's future development, the extent of planned projects, proposed sites and delivery methods. It also includes planning policies instrumental in evaluating development applications. The final draft has been prepared in accordance with Regulation 19 of the Town and Country Planning, Local Planning England Regulations 2012, as amended. This stage of the plan's preparation is considered formal. Public feedback on the plan's legal compliance and adherence to soundness tests is welcome until January the 31st, 2025. The feedback will be dispatched to the government's planning inspectorate with the final draft before an independent examination. Councillor Daniel Candon, Great Yarmouth Borough Council's portfolio holder for economic development and growth, said a huge amount of work has gone into preparing the final draft of local plan. This strategy document, which has to be reviewed by law alongside new government housing targets, will provide an important planning framework for the borough's future. The local plan proposes a target of 6,460 new homes by 2041, alongside an additional 38 hectares for industrial and business developments. Great Yarmouth, Galston and Bradwell will be the main growth focus, delivering approximately 45% of planned housing growth. The plan also aims to regenerate several brownfield sites in Great Yarmouth and Galston, including waterfront locations, and develop sustainable sites on the urban outskirts. Several public exhibitions will be held to discuss the plan's content and assist those wishing to make representations. The drop-in sessions, where planning officers will be on hand to talk about the plan, will take place on Thursday, 9th of January 2025, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Town Hall, on Monday, 13th of January 2025, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Old Village Centre, 2 Green Lane, Bradwell, and Wednesday, January the 15th, 2025, from 4:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at All Saints Parish Hall, Beach Road, Scratby. People are also invited to attend an online webinar at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, 12th of December, where there will be a presentation about the plan, as well as an opportunity to ask questions. Alongside the local plan, the council is also consulting on its Community Infrastructure Levy, CIL, draft charging schedule, which proposes a levy on certain types of new developments, which will be used to pay for infrastructure improvements in the borough. The consultation closes at midnight on Friday, 31st of January 2025. Information about the plan and the Community Infrastructure Levy can be found at localplan.great-yarmouth.gov.uk, where people can view the documents and provide comments. Officials are appealing for information after a spate of fly tipping in Great Yarmouth. The Borough Council's Rangers and Recycling team has shared posts on Facebook showing the rubbish dumped in recent days. They issued an appeal after discovering that waste had been discarded behind a shelter in North Drive. They said it isn't the first time waste had been dumped there, and they haven't been able to obtain any evidence about who disposed of it there. They are asking for people to get in touch if they have any information. The incident follows reports made to the Borough Council last week that building waste materials had been put in litter bins near the Big Wheel, known as the Yarmouth Eye, along the Golden Mile. The council is still appealing for any information as to who might have put the building waste there, and added that these bins are for general litter. The latest reminders by the Rangers and recycling team come as the Borough Council is pushing a scheme to teach people how to correctly use the bins. The family of a young woman who died at a residential home with an unhealthy culture have blasted those who were meant to keep her safe. Holly Goodchild, aged 29, who lived at Signet House in Belton near Great Yarmouth, died in March 2023. An inquest into her death resumed this month, having previously been brought to an abrupt standstill in June. It has since emerged that the hearing was adjourned due to extraordinary allegations between colleagues at the home, which is run by Crystal Care Solutions. Concluding the week-long inquest, Senior Coroner Jacqueline Lake addressed the issues raised. She said, "Clearly there were many concerns raised from the evidence I heard during this inquest. These include an unhealthy culture that had developed at Crystal Care at the time of Holly's death, and a view of the lack of oversight of staff and clear, robust management. Having heard live evidence from Director Jennifer Grego, I am satisfied that Holly's death has been taken seriously and that action has been taken to prevent future deaths occurring." Holly's family blasted the coroner's finding, however, claiming the company had got away with it. When asked about her care, Holly's father, Paul Goodchild, who she would affectionately call Pops, said, "Disgusting. What care? Disgusting. If I'd have known what agony she was in and what pain, I could have got her straight away." Holly's sister, Carla Goodchild, described her sister's treatment as a disgrace and vowed that her legacy would live on. "Just because you're in the system, it doesn't mean you don't have a right to be treated as a human," she added. "Everyone in the care system should be looked after much better than they are. I'm pleased Holly's picture is out there now, so people will know who she was and what a character she was. I just hope lessons are learned and people get the care they should receive." The inquest found that while the family raised many concerns, Mrs. Lake did not deem that Holly died from neglectful behaviour or a gross failure. She said, "Holly had not had a seizure previously while at Crystal Care. I am satisfied that Holly probably did have a seizure on this occasion, based on the evidence of the neurologist and the post-mortem. But I am satisfied also on the balance of probabilities that the carers were not aware of Holly having a seizure. Her support worker considered her behaviours as not overly abnormal, such as to require immediate medical attention. On the basis of the evidence, I cannot find there was a gross failure to provide or procure basic medical attention in the face of an obvious need. And so I cannot neglect as a rider to the conclusion." A support worker had previously dismissed Holly's ultimately fatal collapse as challenging behaviour. Holly's mother became visibly upset midway through the evidence and left the court, telling a carer he had, quote, "just left her to die." Holly was just 29 when she died at Signet House. She had been a resident at the home, which provided care for adults with severe learning disabilities. A post-mortem report concluded that Holly died due to positional asphyxia due to or as a result of epilepsy and morbid obesity. The report added that if Holly had been moved within the first 5 to 6 minutes of her seizure, she would probably have survived. Mrs. Lake gave a short narrative conclusion that outlined the circumstances directly before her death. Carla Goodchild said the family would now be taking some time to reflect and, quote, "see how we go." They hoped to find a plot of land where they could visit in tribute to Holly. Mr. Goodchild added, "Holly was beautiful, bubbly. She was fun, she was clever, she was cheeky. In general, she was a fun person, really kind and intelligent. She loved her family. She was a fantastic kid. I was proud to be her dad. Gorgeous she was, our Holly." Two Albanian men were found hiding under compost bags in the roof of a former bank as a large-scale cannabis factory was discovered, a court has heard. Mark Kohler, aged 35, and Fatjon Halassi, 32, were found hiding in the roof of the former NatWest Bank in Hall Quay, Great Yarmouth. Norwich Crown Court heard the pair were uncovered by police after members of the public alerted officers to a strong smell of cannabis in the area. John Morgans, prosecuting, said officers confirmed the smell when they arrived, while a police drone confirmed a significant heat source emanating from the building. Police forced their way into the property and found a large-scale cannabis factory inside, with drugs growing in 10 rooms of the former bank. Inside were a total of 888 cannabis plants. Mr. Morgans said it was very clearly industrial quantities of cannabis. Halassi, of no fixed abode, appeared in court on Wednesday, December the 11th, having admitted producing Class B cannabis on May the 31st this year. He also admitted drug matters relating to Kent, namely being concerned in the supply of Class B drugs, acquiring criminal property and cultivating cannabis in 2023. Kohler of Hall Quay, Yarmouth, also appeared in court on Wednesday after admitting producing a drug of Class B in May this year. Will Durrance, mitigating for Halassi, said there was no evidence of him directing or organising and insisting he was a gardener at the lower end of the scale. He said he was acting under direction and not, quote, someone who called the shots. He said he was a man of good character who regretted his involvement. Creanna Dodson, mitigating for Kohler, said her client deserved full credit for his plea. She said he worked as a gardener and was only there for a short time after he amassed a £16,000 debt in Albania and was told he had to go and work in the cannabis operation to pay it off. Recorder Nicola Fitches adjourned sentence until December the 19th. A drug dealer was caught hiding behind a curtain when police went to a house as part of a separate operation, a court has heard. Liam Burns, aged 34, had been at a property in Great Yarmouth when police attended while looking into other matters. Norwich Crown Court heard Burns was found at the address, hiding behind a curtain. John Morgans, prosecuting, said his mobile phone was seized by police and found to contain messages indicative of drug supply, relating to both diamorphine and crack cocaine. Mr. Morgans said Burns had been a holder of the phone. Burns, of Deanside, Yarmouth, appeared at court on Wednesday, December the 11th, having admitted offering to supply a quantity of diamorphine and crack cocaine between September and October 2023. Laurie Tucker, mitigating for Burns, who has 36 previous convictions for 76 offences between 2003 and 2024, said he had played a lesser role in the offences, which were Class A drug dealing on a very small scale, and demonstrated his naivety. She said he used his own mobile phone to advertise, to a small number of people, the sale of Class A drugs to which he was addicted at the time. He was a habitual user of heroin and crack cocaine, she said. Miss Tucker accepted the offending had passed the custody threshold, but urged the court to impose a suspended sentence. Recorder Nicola Fitches said Burns had contributed to the devastating impact of drugs in our society, but concluded there was a realistic prospect of rehabilitation in his case. Burns was sentenced to 22 months imprisonment, suspended for 24 months. Miss Fitches said she hoped this would be a turning point for Burns, and he could become a positive member of society. Burns was also ordered to carry out 10 days rehabilitation activity requirement.
More news shortly. But first, the lowdown on Grapevine over Christmas and New Year. Next week, the 20th, is our traditional Christmas edition and will be distributed as usual by post and online. The following week, the 27th edition, will be initially online only, but for our postal listeners will be added to the issue on the 3rd of January to ensure you keep fully informed. Postal listeners, please note that there's no need to return the USB stick until after Christmas if that would cause you a problem. OK, back to the news marathon and Alison, followed closely by Andy and a bit of weird Norfolk.
A prolific shoplifter has confessed to stealing goods worth over £1,500 to fund his crack cocaine addiction. The string of thefts happened between September the 12th and November the 22nd, when Midorgus Vitus, 37, of Wellesley Road in Great Yarmouth, stole from 13 shops and attempted to steal from another. After his arrest and remand, Vitus then engaged with Norfolk Police's Operation Converter, the unit which investigates when a suspect is believed to be responsible for other similar crimes. He then asked for 14 other shoplifting offences to be taken into consideration that happened between July the 29th and November the 11th. Vitus appeared at Norwich Magistrates Court for sentencing on December the 5th, where he was sentenced to a community order of 120 hours unpaid work. He was also issued 15 days of rehabilitative activity requirement and ordered to pay £20 in compensation. In a written statement provided to the court, the 37-year-old said, "I did these things because I was using crack cocaine, but since being in prison I'm getting help and the hospital are helping too. When I get out, I will not be doing stealing anymore." Staff supervisor for Operation Converter, Duncan Etchells, said, "Vitus was stealing on a large scale, often at the same locations. This was solely to feed his out-of-control drug habit. I'm hopeful he will be as good as his word, and if given the appropriate treatment, will become a more productive member of society, which is what he ultimately wants himself. If he fails to take this chance, he will find himself back before the courts again." An inquest into the death of a man who was murdered after being kicked in the face and falling backwards onto concrete has been called off. Last month, Martin Montgomery was sentenced to life imprisonment, with a minimum term of 12 years, for the murder of Nigel Maz. The 32-year-old was found guilty of this murder after a trial at Norwich Crown Court. It heard how Montgomery came out of a flat in Malakoff Close, Great Yarmouth, at just after 11 a.m. on December the 22nd last year. He had been angered by Mr. Maz and two of his friends taking drugs in the stairwell. Montgomery began shouting and swearing after booting Mr. Maz in the head as he bent down to pick something up. The blow caused him to fall backwards onto concrete. With the help of others, Mr. Maz was able to reach Regent Road in the town where the emergency services were called. He died in hospital almost 2 weeks later on January the 4th, aged 59. Speaking at a brief hearing on Monday, Area Coroner Yvonne Blake confirmed that following the proceedings at Crown Court, Norfolk Coroner's Court would be permanently suspending an inquest into Mr. Maz's death. Great Yarmouth's MP has demanded answers from the Home Office over why an illegal immigrant convicted of 17 offences was allowed to stay in the country to commit more crime. Rupert Lowe, Reform MP for Great Yarmouth, has questioned why Alia Sambolta, a 39-year-old from Lithuania, currently on immigration bail, has not been deported despite his track record of criminality. On Monday, December the 9th, he was jailed for drug dealing on Yarmouth's seafront, just weeks after being released from prison. He has previously used 5 different dates of birth and 5 fake names, and has amassed 17 previous convictions, despite being in the country illegally and subject to immigration bail. It has prompted Mr. Lowe to write to Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, calling for his immediate removal. Mr. Lowe said, "If a foreign national comes to the UK and commits a crime, they should be deported. The individual has numerous convictions, yet has remained in our country to offend and offend again. Why has this been tolerated? Great Yarmouth is suffering as a result of soft sentencing and a weak approach to deportation." In a subsequent post on X, previously Twitter, he said, "Call me a racist or whatever else. I honestly don't care. I don't want these criminals in our country." Umbulta was on immigration bail, which is when someone is released while being held on immigration matters, when he committed his recent crimes. He was seen acting suspiciously as he approached a car on Marine Parade by a police officer who recognised him. A search discovered bags of cannabis and keys to a nearby property, where a further 22 grams of the drug and £1,000 in cash were found. He had previously served a 15-week sentence after being convicted of 3 counts of possession with intent to supply, related to drug dealing in 2022 and 2023. Jailing him for 15 weeks, Judge Catherine Moore said imprisonment was the only option after he admitted possession with intent to supply. She said, "The fact that you have managed to amass a number of convictions is troubling. That you are in the UK subject to immigration bail doesn't seem to be any sort of deterrent." The Home Office says people with a criminal record or who pose a risk of reoffending will be less likely to be released on bail. Andrew Oliver, mitigating for Ambulter during his trial at Norwich Crown Court, said he was a cannabis user who had fallen into involvement in supplying people he knew after a personal tragedy. He also committed the crime while homeless, and while his immigration status meant he could not work. Following the criticism, a Home Office spokesman said it cannot comment on individual cases. He said, "Foreign nationals who commit crime should be in zero doubt that we will aim to remove them from the UK at the earliest opportunity." He added that the government's commitment to ramping up deportations has seen 1,520 foreign national offenders returned since Labour came to power in July, an increase of 14% on last year. Deportations can be made when a foreign national has been convicted of an offence and has been jailed for 12 months or more. Foreign nationals convicted of serious harm, persistent offenders, or those representing a threat to national security may also be considered for deportation if it is deemed to be for the public good. Mr. Lowe has been campaigning for more statistics to be published related to crimes committed by foreign nationals. Figures released from the Ministry of Justice, obtained by Mr. Lowe, show that between 2018 and 2022, there were 38,868 re-offences from foreign nationals. Mr. Lowe said, "Since being an MP, I have been inundated with reports of migrant crime. My message on this is clear. Reporting it is absolutely crucial." A woman has been reported for careless driving after her car hit 2 brownies during a Remembrance Day service. The incident happened on Sunday, November the 10th, when the woman, who was driving a white Nissan, refused to stop at a manned barrier marking road closures for the event at the First World War Memorial in Halvergate. Witnesses claimed she drove at the crowd until they moved and clipped 2 members of the Threethorpe Brownies as she ploughed through. It is believed the driver proclaimed, "I'm more concerned with the living than I am with the dead," before she forced her way into the service. As villagers heard the sound of a bugle playing the last post, the Nissan then roared off at speed, with villagers shouting "shame" as the car left. Norfolk police said the woman has since been reported for driving without due care and attention. Motorists charged with the offence face a fine of up to £5,000, penalty points or disqualification from driving. A row over who should fund lifeguards at 3 of the area's busiest beaches has left the council at loggerheads with tourism bosses. Great Yarmouth Borough Council is reviewing its funding that supports the RNLI service at Great Yarmouth, Goulston and Hemsby beaches, which could see it stop providing £29,300 a year. It is the second year this has been proposed, after a previous attempt was paused in order to find alternative sources willing to stump up the cash. Councillors hope the Greater Yarmouth Tourism and Business Improvement Area, known as the GYBID, may take on the costs. But discussions with the organisation, which generates £500,000 a year through a levy on businesses in the designated area, appear to have stalled. Carl Smith, leader of the Conservative-controlled council, said at a recent cabinet meeting, "I am meeting with the GYBID, but it seems they would rather have fireworks than lifeguards." He added that the leaders of the group don't like councillors challenging them. It is understood that GYBID spends about £130,000 a year on fireworks, a figure that has been criticised as an obscene amount by Trevor Wainwright, leader of the Labour opposition group. He has called for spending on this to be redirected towards lifeguards, which he sees as playing a vital role in supporting tourism. Trevor Wainwright said, "If one person loses their life on the beach, it will mean the tourism industry will be sunk. It is a risk to the reputation of the area." Asa Morrison of GYBID said, "We are currently in discussions about the funding, and we are expecting to meet with council representatives in January next year." Cuts to lifeguards is one of several cost-saving measures proposed for next year. It is hoped £300,000 can be raised through a major restructuring of the council, which could involve job losses. Another proposal to introduce car park fees at Galston's Marine Parade car park has been dropped. An ongoing feud between two councils over the management of a pothole-ridden seaside village car park has taken a new twist. The Caister Beach Road car park is the battleground of contention after Caister Parish Council demanded that Great Yarmouth Borough Council, which owns it, either drops charges or forks out for urgent repairs. A Caister Parish Council meeting heard that it was told by GYBC that repairs of the car park would cost £500,000 and the Borough Council were not prepared to alter charges. GYBC told the Parish Council it had no money in the budget to complete a full repair of the site, but said it would fill in some of the worst potholes. From April 1st to September 30th, the car park charges £1.40 per hour, and from October 1st to March 31st, the charges are not enforced. Kevin Wood, chairman of Caister Parish Council, said that due to GYBC's management of the car park, it is mostly empty in the summer months, as visitors cram their vehicles on the streets to avoid paying to park. "We argued that the GYBC do not charge people to park at other sites they manage, such as the cliff tops at Galston," he said. "It doesn't seem fair, considering the car park is in a terrible condition, that GYBC has been taking money out of the machines, yet is not willing to have it repaired. The knock-on effect of it being mostly empty in the summer months is that the streets are crammed with cars as people ditch their vehicles anywhere to avoid paying. GYBC could help the people of Caister by amending the situation here, but they are not interested." Mr. Wood added that considering the car park refurbishment for the Caister playing ground would cost the parish £20,000, he believes the beach road revamp would be in the region of £100,000 rather than the quoted £500,000. A GYBC spokesman said, "Caister Parish Council has been informed the cost of a full replacement of the surface for Beach Road car park is estimated to be just under £500,000 because the car park is large with a predominantly tarmac surface. There is no budget provision for these full replacement works to be undertaken. The council regularly undertakes remedial work at the site to address potholes, and this maintenance will continue. There are no plans to remove the charging at Beach Road car park in the summer period." Great Yarmouth Port has agreed a deal to pre-assemble wind turbines for a £4 billion wind farm off the coast. Peel Ports Great Yarmouth will pre-assemble various components for 64 offshore turbines for Scottish Power Renewables' East Anglia 2 site. The port operator and green energy firm have signed a reservation agreement that will see 192 turbine blades manufactured at the Siemens Gamesa factory in Hull come together for assembly in Great Yarmouth before installation in the southern North Sea. East Anglia 2 is located 33 kilometres off the Suffolk coast and will have the capacity to generate up to 960 megawatts of green electricity, enough to power the equivalent of almost 1 million homes. Offshore construction for East Anglia 2 is expected to get underway in 2027, with the wind farm becoming operational in 2028. Ross Ovens, Scottish Power Renewables Managing Director for Offshore, said, "Building more green energy for the UK in the UK delivers energy security and reduces our reliance on fossil fuels, which will help bring down customer bills. But it also does much more than that. It makes a real difference for people and places, creating jobs, growth and lasting economic benefits. It's fantastic to be working with Peel Ports Great Yarmouth to bring that to life for people and businesses across East Anglia, while showcasing the world-class facilities we have here on our doorstep to support a global industry. I look forward to seeing our towers of green power take shape when the project gets underway." Richard Goffin, Port Director at Peel Ports Group, said, We're very proud that Scottish Power Renewables has once again chosen Great Yarmouth to support this huge project, having previously worked together on the East Anglia One development. This continued partnership reflects confidence in our port's capabilities, facilities and team. Great Yarmouth has proved itself to be an outstanding base for the growing offshore renewables market, not just in the southern North Sea, but extending further afield, including the North Sea. Centre 81, a charity in Great Yarmouth for people with disabilities, has appointed a new chief executive. Alison Holmes has taken over from Diana Staines, who is stepping down after 17 years, and who during her time earned an MBE in 2022 for her work with people with disabilities. Ms Staines transformed Centre 81 from a day centre into a member-focused charity, encouraging disabled people to have fun, learn new skills and engage with the community, all based on the charity's belief in ability, not disability. Her ambition to provide a more spacious home for Centre 81 was realised in 2022 when the charity relocated from Tarworks Road to Yare House on Morton Peto Road. The charity's new head, who was previously Business Development Director at Norse Care, has a wealth of senior level experience in the care and supported accommodation sectors. Ms Holmes is excited about the challenge of completing the redevelopment of Yare House into a top-tier facility for disabled people and their family carers. She said, "I feel thrilled, honoured and grateful to have been offered the role of Chief Executive at Centre 81 and have admired the organisation professionally for many years. We are also very grateful for the firm foundations Diana has put in place. I know I have big boots to fill and I will commit all my passions and energy to deliver the future for the Centre 81. Centre 81 runs a skills and activities centre catering to about 70 people with various disabilities. It also provides a community transport service used by more than 500 people who can't access traditional public transport for purposes such as shopping trips, medical appointments and visiting family and friends. The charity also offers fully accessible shower and bath facilities for non-members. Further details about Centre 81 services can be found on their website. A man who lost his home to coastal erosion a year ago today has said he is heartbroken that so many families still face the same fate. Kevin Jordan's house sat on the clifftops at Hemsby until it was demolished on December the 9th last year as Great Yarmouth Borough Council feared there was a high risk it would fall into the sea. In the months that followed, Mr. Jordan turned to activism to help protect others in similar circumstances. He hit the national press earlier this year when he teamed up with disability activist Doug Pawley and environmental campaign group Friends of the Earth to challenge the former Conservative government's National Adaptation Programme called the NAP. The NAP outlined the government's response to the risks posed by climate change, but Mr. Jordan and his associates claimed it was deficient, as it failed to properly address 61 climate change risks. They took their concerns to the High Court, but the case was dismissed. The group is now working on an appeal and expects to hear back within 2 to 3 months. "It is heartbreaking to see more homes on the Hemsby coastline under threat," Mr. Jordan said. "Climate change is fueling this crisis. When I bought my home 15 years ago, I was advised it would be safe for decades to come. The government's climate adaptation plan is seriously inadequate, and unless it is massively improved, communities across the country will be at risk from our rapidly changing weather. I hope this appeal succeeds and forces the government to give better protection to the hundreds of thousands of homes in England currently at risk of coastal flooding and erosion." The anniversary comes after the UK was battered by Storm Dara over the weekend. Hemsby is feared to have lost 1 to 2 metres of coastline, but Hemsby lifeboat coxswain Dan Hurd has reassured it was not as bad as expected.
Hello, this is Andy with another of the weird Norfolk stories. And this one concerns bringing the dead back to life at Broomholme Priory. The ruins are spectacular and hint at a majesty long since claimed by time. But the broken walls of Broomholme Priory hide an even bigger secret. They once housed a holy relic said to be so powerful it could raise the dead. Also known as Bacton Abbey or Broomholme Priory, the building was founded 1113 by William de Glanville as a sister abbey of near Castle Acre and stands as a lonely sentry in fields just off the scenic northeast Norfolk coast road. These days, Bacton's fame is bound up in gas. But travel back in time to 1205, and Bacton was nothing short of miraculous. For the first century of its life, Broomholme was a staging post on the pilgrim route to Walsingham. But in 1205, its fortunes changed, thanks to a tiny wooden cross, no bigger than a man's hand, which, it was said, was a relic of the true cross on which Jesus died. Soldiers of the Fourth Crusade had ransacked Constantinople, bringing back a hoard of treasure, both spiritual and secular. A local priest, who had been with the emperor in Constantinople, brought back the two pieces of wood, which he offered to the Clunykiel monks at Broomholme, on condition that he and his sons were admitted to the priory. The monastery, poor in worldly goods but rich in faith, believed the priest and agreed to his terms. His cross, said to have been made by St. Helena from parts of the cross to which Christ's hands and feet was nailed, was set up in the church and it proved to be Broomholme's salvation. Matthew Paris's illuminated medieval manuscript, Chronica Magiana, contained information about the cross, which drew from Flores Hostarium by Roger of Wendhoven in his Annals for 1223. In the same year, divine miracles became frequent occurrences at Broomholme, so the glory and honour of the life-giving cross on which the Saviour of the world suffered for the redemption of mankind, it reads. The manuscript then reveals that the relic was brought to Broomholme by King Baldwin's chaplain, who had already been refused by several other monasteries, but was enthusiastically welcomed in Norfolk. In this year, divine miracles began to be wrought in that monastery to the praise and glory of the life-giving cross. For there the dead were restored to life, the blind recovered their sight, and any sick person who approached the aforesaid cross with faith went away safe and sound. In all, 39 people were raised from the dead. 19 people had their sight restored, and pilgrims, including Henry III, flocked to Broomholme with gracious offerings. The cross is mentioned in Reeve's tale, the third of Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales written in the 1380s. Miller Simkin lives near Cambridge and steals the wheaten meal brought to him for grinding. Two students set out to get revenge for their college steward who fell victim to Simkin and orchestrate a farce-like situation involving wives, daughters and bed-hopping. At one point, the miller's wife is woken when her husband falls. "Help," she screamed, "Holy Cross at Broomholme, keep us, Lord, into our hands." Within 50 years of Chaucer's work, the end would be nigh for Broomholme's claim to fame. In 1424, Sir Hugh Pye, a Protestant chaplain from Norwich, was tried before the Bishop of Norwich for having thrown the relic on a fire. In the Acts and Monuments of John Fox of 1424, it says that Pye was brought before the bishop on July the 5th, 1424, for holding these opinions following: that people ought not to go on pilgrimage, that the people ought not to give alms, that the image of the cross and other images are not to be worshipped. Pye denied the charges, whereupon he had a day appointed to purge himself by the witness of three laymen and three priests. That done so, He was sworn as the other before and so dismissed. 2 years later, the bishop recalled Pye regarding the death of William White, who had been burned at the stake for heresy and been associated with White, a fellow Lollard. Pye was reprieved yet again, but Broomholme Priory had lost its miraculous attraction, and never again wealthy visitors keen to part with gifts in return for touching wood.
It's time that we get you totally up to date with the rest of this week's local news. So, over to Alison.
A man in his 30s has died following a crash on the A47. The collision happened at 8:40 p.m. on Wednesday on the southbound carriageway between Hopton and Galston. A blue Vauxhall Astra and a white Range Rover Evoque were involved in the crash. The driver of the Range Rover, a man in his 30s, died at the scene. The driver of the Vauxhall, a man in his 20s, was arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving and drug driving. He was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Station for questioning, where he remains. The road was closed while emergency services, including fire and ambulance crews, attended the scene, and it remained shut for some time. Police would like to speak to anyone who witnessed the crash or the manner of driving prior to the collision. A road in Galston has been closed as a week-long bomb search begins. Teams from Norfolk County Council are looking for bombs and ordnance left over from the Second World War. Riverside Road was shut last week for the investigation, which is assessing the site for a new retaining wall to protect the carriageway from erosion and flooding. The construction of a 150-metre sheet-piled wall is planned for next year, pending permits and planning approval. Locals are hoping to avoid what happened in 2023 in February, when a 250-kilo German bomb was found in neighbouring Great Yarmouth. Army specialists were attempting to disarm it when the device blew up, sending echoes and shakes for up to 15 miles. The new search lasted until December the 13th, with the road being closed from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. A spokesman for the county council said, "If any explosives are found, appropriate safety measures will be implemented. Local businesses and residents will be kept informed. Although the likelihood of finding anything is very low, Norfolk County Council will ensure the utmost care and diligence whilst conducting this operation." Villagers have been left devastated after failing to halt plans to build 55 homes they fear will ruin the community and cause traffic mayhem. Councillors have approved the scheme in Ormsby amid a tense atmosphere at Great Yarmouth's Town Hall on Wednesday night, which saw dozens of people voicing their concerns. Signs were held up by protesters as the planning committee at Great Yarmouth Borough Council debated the proposal by Flagship, one of the biggest housing developers in the county, to construct the homes on farmland at the end of a quiet cul-de-sac off Barton Way. Officers had recommended for the scheme to be approved prior to the meeting, highlighting that it will deliver much-needed homes for the village. Nearly 50% would be offered as affordable rentals. But locals have numerous concerns that range from danger increased traffic could bring, a lack of job opportunities in the area, and harm it could cause to wildlife. This led more than 400 people to write letters of objection to GYBC. Impassioned speeches from parish councillors and villagers gained a round of applause from the fervent crowd as they attempted to persuade councillors to reject the scheme. Phil Nathan, chair of the parish council, said this is the wrong place and the wrong time. While Phil Mayhew, one of the worried villagers, added, "This will change the village forever." He noted in all his 40 years living in Ormsby, he had never known villages to come together like this. Councillors were sympathetic to the concerns of the village, but overall saw many benefits in the scheme. It was noted that there were no objections from any of the statutory consultees, such as Norfolk County Council's Highways Department, to justify refusing the project. Brian Pilkington, a Labour councillor who grew up in Ormsby, shared his own experience of having to move from the village due to being unable to afford to live there. "An application like this will help lots of younger people stay in the village," he said. Councillors went on to approve the scheme, which led to angry shouting from the public gallery, with dozens of people clearly devastated and frustrated at the decision. Rupert Lowe, Reform MP for Great Yarmouth, appeared to see the opposition in Ormsby as an opportunity to push his own agenda of opposing the council's wider local plan, setting out where thousands of homes can be built to meet the housing need in the borough. It follows a row breaking out previously between the Conservative Left Council and Mr. Lowe, who was accused of stirring up accusations of corruption levelled at the council. His office manager, John Whedon, spoke on his behalf during the meeting. He said clearly there is opposition to the scale of house building in Yarmouth, which will only get worse under Labour. It led to a war of words with councillors attacking his stance, with Carl Annison, Conservative councillor for Bradswell, describing his speech as a party political broadcast. Bernard Williamson, a Labour councillor for Claydon Ward, added, "We have a housing need. If you are opposing these homes, how will that be met?" Others highlighted how failing to meet housing targets and having a local plan could leave the council at risk of legal action. Mr. Whedon did not have many answers to these questions, but reiterated Mr. Lowe's stance that new housing must be sensible and limited to the right areas. Both the council and Mr. Lowe have offered to meet to discuss these issues, but so far the invitations have not led to a meeting. An important gateway into Great Yarmouth could see a new lease of life, with renovation work expected to begin next year. Great Yarmouth Borough Council said it is finalising plans to restore Vauxhall Bridge, which provides a vital connection from the railway station and Asda to North Quay for cyclists and pedestrians. The bridge was part renovated in 2013. Currently, the council is working with the owners of the crossing and other stakeholders before presenting final plans in the new year. It is anticipated that, with all the agreements in place, work could start by the end of summer 2025. The project is part of wider plans to regenerate North Quay, as the council prepares to appoint a developer for the 10-acre site. The authority is inviting final tenders from builders by December the 20th. The applications will then be evaluated before a contract is awarded. The work comes after the council last year secured £20 million from the government's Levelling Up Fund to help prepare the North Quay site and encourage commercial investment in the area. It is hoped the regeneration of North Quay will create a new centrally located mixed-use neighbourhood, complementing the town centre with strong connections between the railway station and the town centre and waterfront. Councillor Carl Smith, council leader, said, "There is huge potential for the North Quay site, which has been an eyesore for too long. With the river and Breydon Water on one side and the close link into the town centre on the other. With negotiations going very well around land assembly, we're determined to unlock that potential with a transformational mixed-use development that will benefit the whole borough." Councillor Trevor Wainwright, leader of the council's Labour group, said, "North Quay is an important strategic site for the town and a gateway area between the railway station and the marketplace. The appointment of a master developer will bring our ambitious vision for Great Yarmouth a step closer and is an important milestone. The council has also been working with the Environment Agency as it develops engineering proposals for a flood resilience strategy for the land that includes contingencies for climate change. Once appointed, the new master developer will continue to work on the design for a flood defence strategy that will be incorporated into the proposals for the North Quay site." Councillor Smith said, "We want to make this key entry point into Great Yarmouth a vibrant new neighbourhood for people who live, work and visit the town. The appointment of a master developer for the project will be a major step forward." Ian Robertson, the Borough Council's Executive Director for Major Projects, said, "We have made very positive progress with most of the property owners at North Quay. But I would urge those with freehold and leasehold interests who have not yet come forward to contact me as soon as possible so we can discuss their interests." Mr. Robertson said negotiation with property owners is being done in tandem with drawing up compulsory purchase order procedures, should they be needed as a last resort. Vauxhall Bridge first opened in 1852 and has been described as a rare survival of a wrought iron railway bridge. The crossing served as a key gateway between town and country and carried horse, train, tram, car and foot passengers over its lifetime. In 1976, the railway line from the station to North and South Quays was closed, but people could still drive over until 1988, when it was closed to vehicles. A tree, loved by many who visit a tranquil town park, will be chopped down. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has announced that the beech tree, which stands at the centre of Priory Gardens, off Church Road in Galston, will be removed. In a post on Facebook, the authority said the decision was made with a heavy heart and following a careful assessment by an arborist. They said that mushrooms growing on the trunk were a sign that the tree is dying and no longer safe structurally. Given its location and the potential risks it poses, the tree will be cut down, they added. A stump will remain to serve educational purposes, highlighting the decay and compartmentalisation within the tree's structure. Two new beech trees will be planted in its place, with the hope that they will grow into mature specimens. Site notices will be posted to inform the public about the upcoming work and the start date for the removal. Norfolk Highways lodged plans to reduce how fast motorists can drive along Decoy Road in Ormsby St Margaret to improve safety in the village. The section of the road that could be changed leads into the village and is near the North Road junction. It comes as a controversial proposal to build 55 homes on farmland in nearby Barton Way hangs in the balance. The bid by the Housing Association Flagship has led to the council receiving 400 letters of objection amid concern that it will cause too much traffic and pressure on services. Norfolk Highways is asking people to share their views on the proposed speed limit change by emailing trafficorders@norfolk.gov.uk. A £425,000 land deal has been struck to allow a school to double in size and move to a new site to cope with hundreds of new homes. Norfolk County Council wants to build a new £11.3 million primary school at the Wheatcroft Farm housing development on Chaplin Road at Bradwell near Great Yarmouth. The new 420 pupil capacity school would replace the existing Homefield C of E primary school on Homefield Avenue in Bradwell, which can only cater for 210 children. Persimmon was granted planning permission for around 700 homes at Wheatcroft Farm a decade ago, at which point an agreement was made with County Hall and third-party landowners for land to be given to the council for a new school. But that deal only covered the free transfer of 2.5 acres of land, and the council needs a further 1.5 acres for the new school. The council has been negotiating with Persimmon over obtaining that land, and after a prolonged period of discussions, a price of £425,000 was agreed. Jane James, the council's cabinet member for innovation, transformation and performance, used delegated powers to agree the purchase of the land. The school currently accepts pupils aged from 3 to 11, but the replacement would admit pupils aged 4 to 11, with 60 children in each year group. The council said the new school, a two-storey building with 14 classrooms, is needed because of the number of primary school-aged children expected to move into 1,000 new homes in Bradwell. Some 360 of the new homes are yet to be built, and County Hall officials said existing primary schools would not be able to take the extra pupils. Consultation over the council's intended changes, which would see the new school welcome its first pupils in spring 2027, runs until Monday, December the 16th. In a previous consultation, 51% disagreed or strongly disagreed with the proposals. Concerns raised included wanting to keep the school as it is, preferring smaller classrooms, ability to walk to school, and the existing ethos. Council officials acknowledged the mixed response, but said they had a statutory duty to ensure sufficient school places, while the proposals were supported by school governors and staff. A young St John ambulance volunteer from Great Yarmouth has been recognised for his remarkable achievements. Elliot Brooke, aged 18, was honoured at the Young Achievers Reception, an annual event which celebrates the exceptional contributions of young St John ambulance members. The event was attended by the Princess Royal, who has served as St John's Commandant-in-Chief, Youth, for many years. Elliot's journey with St John Ambulance started at the age of 5, when he joined the Badgers. By 13, he had already achieved the prestigious Grand Prior Award. Elliot not only cares for his mother, who suffers from fibromyalgia, but also manages his own health issues, which include chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. In the last 2 years, he has balanced his GCSEs and A-level studies while remaining an active and invaluable member of St John Ambulance. Despite his personal challenges, Elliot helps unit leaders and mentors new cadets every week. He has played a key role in organising district-level events, including a Cadet Leader 1 course and a Badger sleepover. He is currently involved in planning a Badger residential event set for later this year. Elliot's efforts have consistently exceeded expectations. In recognition of his outstanding contributions, Elliot was nominated for a Young Diamonds Award by multiple organisations, including his school, the Scouts and St John Ambulance. Elliot said, "I was very surprised to hear I was nominated. I really enjoyed heading down to London and meeting the princess. She was very nice, and we even had an entertaining discussion about Norfolk and its geography. Kevin Munday, St John Ambulance's chief commissioner, said, "Hearing their stories was truly inspiring, and all of us at St John are constantly impressed by just how much our young people can achieve in often difficult circumstances. We congratulate them all." Families across Norfolk may receive a helping hand this festive season, with supermarket vouchers available through the Household Support Fund, known as HSF. The government-backed scheme aims to assist hard-up households with the rising cost of living, and saw Norfolk County Council receive £6.7 million in funding. Administered by local councils, in Norfolk families with children eligible for free school meals will receive a monthly cost of living voucher and should receive the vouchers automatically through their child's school. The vouchers are £15 per month per child, and there is an additional payment of £30 in December for the Christmas holiday period. The vouchers are provided by Edenred and will be paid up to and including March 2025. They can be used for food and groceries in-store at Morrisons, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda, Waitrose, M&S Food, McColl's, including RS McColl's and Martin's, and Aldi. The vouchers can also be used online at Asda and Waitrose. Further information can be found at the Norfolk County Council website. Potter's Resort has filmed a spoof of the famous cue card scene from Love Actually. Potter's Resorts made the video in Galston to promote their New Year's break at Hopton. The video stars resort compere Jack Jenkins, who recreates the moment when Mark stands on Juliet's doorstep posing as a carol singer. In this version, Mr. Jenkins appears at the door with cards that explain why celebrating New Year's at Potter's is the ultimate way to welcome in 2025. So far, the clip has been watched 500,000 times on social media. Managing Director Mike Scott said, "We are always finding creative ways to entertain our guests, whether they're visiting us at the resorts or engaging with us on social media. This video perfectly captures the magic and charm of Love Actually, while reminding people why Potter's is the ideal destination for a New Year's party." Mr. Jenkins said, "It's been a busy year for me, from hosting events to raising over £50,000 for Norfolk Accident Rescue Service. But filming this was just an evening of pure fun. The fact that it's gone viral is crazy. We wanted to bring a smile to people's faces, and I think the Love Actually parody did exactly that." Social media manager Tara Scott, who also features in the video, said, "This was such a fun project to work on. We wanted to create something light-hearted and festive that also showcases the unforgettable experience guests can enjoy at Potter's Resorts. The feedback has been overwhelming, and we're thrilled that people are loving it as much as we do." Recently, Keira Knightley told Variety magazine that the slightly stalker-ish effect of the cue card scene was quite creepy. To watch the spoof, go to Potter's Facebook page. A new children's soft play centre is set to open on the site of a former gym. William Tingey of Mini Monsters Limited, a business based in Northamptonshire, is planning to open the entertainment area across two units in Harfrey's Industrial Estate, on Bessemer Way in Great Yarmouth. Previously, the premises had traded as Be Well Gym since 2006, but that went into liquidation and closed in July last year, with the owner blaming the arrival in the town of two national gym chains. The new plans will see the vacant units reopen as a children's soft play centre. Great Yarmouth Borough Council approved Mr. Tingey's application for a certificate of lawful proposed use, which means he will not require planning permission. In his application, he said the last use of the building had fallen under the same operating category as the proposed use for a children's soft play facility. The building has been previously utilised for activities that align with leisure purposes, which is consistent with the nature of a children's soft play facility, he said. An annual Santa Dash has brought festive cheer to Galston and raised more than £4,000 for a hospice charity. On Sunday, the Santa Dash 2024 was held to raise money for St. Elizabeth East Coast Hospice. With donations still rolling in, the charity event drew more than 120 participants dressed as Santa Claus and other Christmas-themed characters. Runners took on either a family fun run or a 5K race along the picturesque Galston Clifftop and promenade, with spectators lining the route to cheer them on. Sponsored by Persimmon Homes, the event supports the hospice's mission to provide essential care to patients and families in Great Yarmouth and Waveney. Since its launch in 2019, the hospice, in partnership with East Coast Community Healthcare, has supported over 5,000 patients and their loved ones. Brandon Orton, Events and Challenges fundraiser at St Elizabeth's East Coast Hospice, expressed gratitude for the community's support. He said, "What a fantastic day of festive fun. A big thank you to everyone who made our Santa Dash a success, from the incredible volunteers and enthusiastic runners to the spectators who kept everyone motivated. We are thrilled to have raised this amazing amount to support our services in Great Yarmouth and Waveney, helping us to provide essential care to patients and families when support matters most in their lives." The results of the 5K timed race saw Christopher Fuller finish as the fastest male with a time of 18 minutes and 53 seconds, while Kirsty Wheeler finished as the fastest female in an impressive time of 22 minutes and 46 seconds. Funds raised will help the hospice continue its vital work, offering compassionate care and support to those in need during challenging times. For more information, visit www.stelizabethhospice.org.uk.
Well, that's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2024 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Your newsreader next week will be Desney, joined by a cast of thousands to bring you some festive bits and pieces which we hope you'll enjoy. So as the saying goes, we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. With added jingle bells. In the meantime, from all of us here at Grapevine, stay safe and well, and bye for now.